This Is Your Life, episode 75. Hello and welcome to this episode of This Is Your Life. My name is Michael Hyatt, and this is the podcast dedicated to intentional leadership. My goal is to help you live with more passion, work with greater focus, and lead with extraordinary influence. In this episode, I'll be talking about my top 10 productivity hacks. In interviews, I'm often asked, how do you get so much done? Well, in this episode, I'm going to tell you. You can find the outline, the resource links, and there's a lot of them in this episode, and a complete transcript in the show notes at michaelhyatt.com/75, as in episode 75. I'll be back in a minute with my top productivity hacks.
Thinking of starting your own blog but worried that your technical know-how is not up to scratch?
The good news is that starting blogging has never been easier.
Michael shares his knowledge with you free and will show you that 20 minutes is all it takes to have your own blog up and running.
Hi, this is Trevor Torres from DiabetesEvangelist.com. Man, your screencast just took all the stress out of setting up my website. Thanks so much.
Join Michael and follow his quick and easy step-by-step video tutorial at michaelhyatt.com/WordPress Setup at michaelhyatt.com/WordPress Setup.
Take action now and start blogging today.
I love the topic of productivity. I collect productivity hacks or tips like some people, I suppose, collect stamps. I love reading about it. I love talking about it. I love gleaning what I can, always trying to optimize my workflow so that I can get more work done. And for me, it's really just kind of a game. I just like being as efficient and as effective as I can. So I thought I'd share that with you, my top 10 favorite productivity hacks of all time. These aren't any particular order, but I've just tried to glean these from my blog and elsewhere and just looking at my own daily practice. What do I do that makes me so productive? And this is one of those things that I think that for me, I take for granted because I'm just on the inside of me looking out at the world and all I know is what I know. And I just do this kind of naturally. It's something that comes naturally to me, but I realize that for a lot of people, it doesn't. And people are always looking for that edge. And I hope you can find it in some of the ideas I'm going to share in this episode. But my first productivity hack that I would recommend is to eliminate online distractions. And I devoted an entire podcast to this called How to Shave 10 Hours Off Your Work Week. And there's a link in the show notes. But the number one tip that I shared there and the number one hack that I want to share with you in this episode is to limit your time online. You know, this is the biggest time suck of all time. I love the internet as well as the next guy. But the truth is, the internet, if we're not careful, can lead us down a dark hallway where one door opens to another, and before long, we're lost, and we've kind of lost the plot. And that happens to me just like it probably happens to you, and one of the ways to protect against that, especially when you have to be productive, is to use some software that limits your time online. And let me just give you a couple of recommendations. These are those that I found helpful in the past, and at the very least, just shut down text messaging, turn off your phone, shut down your email app, turn off Twitter, Facebook, and all the rest so that you can give your focus to the task at hand. Because none of us, I promise, are good at multitasking. That's really a myth. I know that a lot of people think they can multitask. At best, they time slice, which means that they're able to devote attention to one task and then shift it to another task and another task. But this is horribly inefficient. I mean, there have been numerous studies out there that have proven this over and over again, so I won't go into that. But here's some software tools that you might look at. One's called Antisocial, which is pretty clever. Works now on the Mac or the PC. It used to be Mac only, but now it works for the PC as well. But what it enables you to do is to shut off the social aspects of the web so that you still have access, and I need this as a writer, to websites where I can do research. So I can't get on Twitter, I can't get on Facebook, can't even get on email, but I can get access to the parts of the web that I need access to, which are websites that are not social, where I can do my research. Another software package, I don't use this one, but this is one that's come highly recommended. It's called Freedom. Again, a link in the show notes. That's Mac or PC. And then one that's PC only is one called Cold Turkey. And a pretty clever name, because I think for most of us, when we try to go off the web or off the internet, that's what we experience, the shakes. You know, we're used to that dopamine hit that comes from instant gratification, and we experience that on the web, which explains why so many of us are addicted to the web. Second hack I would recommend is schedule time alone. You know, we schedule meetings with others. We may even schedule one-on-one time with the people that report to us or our friends or family members, whatever. But here I want to talk about scheduling time alone. And Jason Friedman calls this the alone zone, time in the alone zone. And man, I think you've got to have this. I know I do, to be productive. For me, this is that morning time is an example of it, where from about 4:45 in the morning when I get up till 8 o'clock, I don't take appointments. I don't try to take early morning flights. I don't have breakfast meetings, but that is my time to kind of go through my morning ritual and really get set up for a day of productivity. And if I lose that time in the morning, my day gets off to a rocky start. And so I protect that. That's time in the alone zone for me. Another opportunity for me is routine work. So blog posts, podcasts, I schedule those. You know, there's no, it's not a meeting. I'm not meeting with anybody else. But for example, me doing this podcast right now, when I'm doing this on Monday, is a time that I put on my calendar, and it looks to the rest of the world like I have an appointment, like I've got a commitment. And that was one of the secrets that I used in the corporate world when I was the CEO of Thomas Nelson, is that I would schedule these alone times so that when people were trying to find a time with me, it came up on our corporate calendar as a commitment. They didn't have the detail of what the commitment was. But from my perspective, that was a legitimate commitment. It was just as legitimate as a meeting that I would have somebody with someone else outside of my office or someone outside of my company. It was a completely legit meeting, and I had to protect that time if I was going to get anything done. Because here's what happens to most of us. We spend all day at the office meeting with other people. Meanwhile, our inbox is getting stuffed to overflowing with people that are making requests, making demands, giving us information, and there's no time to do our work, so that we drag that home with us and end up having to do that on time that we borrow from our family or from our health or something else that's more important. I also schedule time for special projects. I'm working on a project that we're about to announce in about a week, and I've got some bonus material that I've got to create tomorrow and the next day. So I've just blocked out the day. Again, that's on my calendar. Travel time is another time that you can spend time in the alone zone, and I really try to make that work for me as well. I don't think I'm ever more productive than I am when I'm in an airplane at about 35,000 feet in the air. For some reason, there's just something about that. I don't know if it's the white noise or the fact that there's a little bit of distraction, but not a lot of distraction, that keeps me focused. But man, I can get so much done in an airplane. So you might want to read a post I did called Scheduling Time in the Alone Zone. I've got a link in the show notes to that. But that's my second hack, is to schedule time alone. Third hack. Batch similar tasks together. Now, I wrote a post a while back called How to Create More Margin in Your Life. And in that post, I talk about something I've practiced probably for a decade called my ideal week. And there's a template there that you can download. It's an Excel spreadsheet, but it basically helps you map out what your ideal week would look like if you had 100% complete control over the time. Now, this is not something that we have the privilege of enjoying very often, because there are interruptions, there are exceptions, things that conspire against us to keep that ideal week from happening. But if you don't know what it looks like, how can you even get close to approximating what it would be in your work? And so I like to just map it out. And I go through similar things, and I put, for example, I group my days by themes. So for example, Monday for me is the day when I write my blog posts. And back in the corporate world, it was the day I met with my direct reports. but I batched it together. I did similar things together because that's when you're the most efficient. That's when you're kind of in the headspace that those kinds of tasks and those kinds of activities require. Tuesday for me is podcast day. And again, that's a day when I kind of get into that mindset. Wednesday and Thursday are special projects days. And Friday for me is something I borrow from my friend Don Miller called Friendly Friday, but that's really the only day that I now accept appointments. I batch them all together. I'm an introvert by nature, and frankly, I'm trying to produce a lot of content. So Monday through Thursday is reserved for that, and Friday for me is when I take appointments and meet with people in the outside world. Occasionally, I'll meet with somebody that's on a different day than that, but it's very rare because my ideal week wants to batch those together. Another thing I try to do, though, too, is not only focus the days by themes, but the time of days into focus areas. So that, for example, early in the morning is that time when I sharpen the saw. You know, I'm working on my intellectual, spiritual, emotional, physical health, and just, you know, making sure that I'm tending to those things that, frankly, matter the most. But because they're not urgent and they're just important, and I say just important with tongue in cheek, they're easy to push off unless I allocate a time for them and make specific time on my calendar for them. Then in the middle of the day, I obviously work. And then at the end of the day is that time reserved for my family and friends. So this is just kind of how I think about it. And again, you can go to this post, How to Create More Margin in Your Life, and that'll give you that template for the ideal week. And I think that'll really help you as you think through your week as well. Well, hack number four is identify your must-dos. Now, I have a task list every day. You probably have one as well. I use a software program called Nozbe, N-O-Z-B-E, and that's what I've used for years. I love it. I use Basecamp for group projects and for project management, but for my own personal task management, I use Nozbe. And I have a context. I follow the getting things done kind of formula that David Allen came up with, where he talks about grouping tasks that appear for you in a specific context. And the other way to think about this is like a tag that you put on a task. And you might, for example, tag certain tasks, errands, or calls, or writing, or things that are similar in nature. I have a context called must do, and it's all one word, at must do. And I tag three tasks a day that are my must do's that, you know, no matter what happens, no matter what interruptions, no matter what urgent things come pressing, these are the three things that at least at the beginning of the day, I am going to do no matter what. And I attack these first. And that's the secret, because it's easy to push these off and to get sidetracked by email or social media or the interruptions that happen naturally in the office place and not get to your must-dos. But for me, the must-dos are the priority items that I'm going to put first. I'm going to attack those first so that no matter what else happens, those are the things that get done. So the fourth hack, identify your must-dos. Fifth hack, eliminate, automate, and delegate. Now, this is the premise of Timothy Ferriss's book, The 4-Hour Workweek. And if you haven't read that book, you must read it. I don't endorse everything in the book, but there are a few books that I've read that have stimulated my thinking more than that book. I read it with my mentoring group. I read it probably about three times myself. And make sure, by the way, you get the updated, expanded version of the book. But it's full of great ideas. And if you're going to be successful, if you're going to be productive, you've got to learn to do these three things: eliminate, automate, and delegate. But I just want to focus, for the sake of this hack, on delegation. Delegation is a huge help. If you can learn to delegate and to use a team, and I'll talk more about that in just a minute, how you get a team like that, but to offload the things that you think, and so often we all think this, that we just have to do. You know, nobody's as good as we are at it. Or we may think to ourselves, gosh, it takes me as long to explain this to somebody else as it does to just do it. So I'm just going to do it. Well, tasks always take longer initially. But if you're going to learn the art of delegation, you'll learn to put up with that and work through that so that you buy yourself time as somebody else gets proficient in the thing that you thought that only you could do. And I was recently having a conversation with one of my daughters, Mary, about this very task. And she said, well, Dad, how do you know what to delegate first? So I thought that was a great question. And I thought, I'm going to write a blog post about that. And I did. And that was just posted on my blog yesterday, if you're listening to this on Wednesday. But it's called What Tasks Should You Delegate First? And I have a little 2x2 matrix in the blog post that helps you kind of assess that and analyze it and get crystal clear on what you would offload first. So I would encourage you to take a look at that. Again, a link in the show notes. And I know in this episode, I'm giving you a lot of resources, but I think you're going to find them very helpful. And this is probably an episode that you're going to want to go back to a few times. And certainly the show notes you're going to want to go to, because that's where all the links are to these various tools. That brings me to hack number 6, and that's hire virtual assistants. I don't know of anything that has increased my productivity more than having a virtual assistant. And I wrote about this in a new ebook that I released about a month ago called The Virtual Assistant Solution, and get the subtitle, Come Up for Air, Offload the Work You Hate, and Focus on What You Do Best. That, to me, is the great benefit of having a virtual assistant, is it enables you to focus on those tasks where you add the most value and get rid of the stuff that drains you, that's exhausting, and that, frankly, you're not that good at. And I talk about in the ebook how you can figure out whether or not you can afford a virtual assistant. And I'm going to tell you, there are hundreds of people that I've talked to, maybe thousands by this time, that didn't think they could afford a virtual assistant because they're not thinking about it in a proper economic way, and they're not thinking creatively enough about it. And I help you do that in the book. So the book's only like $2.99. So you can pick it up on Amazon. Again, a link in the show notes. But it gives you some ideas about that and how you can use virtual assistants to build a team of people. And that's obviously the secret for getting more done, because how many times have you said to yourself as you come to the end of a day, gosh, I just need two of me. Or you say to yourself, I need more hours in the day. Well, virtual assistants are a way to multiply both. And I use, by the way, a company called EA Help. And I've been working together with them now for over 2 years. I have two virtual assistants with them, and they do a superb job if you're in the market for somebody that you can really trust and will really hire the kinds of people that will represent you well. And that was a huge requirement for me. I just didn't want somebody, you know, out of the country that I couldn't really have a sense that they would represent me well, or that would do the work in a way that I felt proud of. And EA Help has enabled me to do that. Seventh hack. Invest in coaching. I almost put invest in education, but it's more than that. It's invest in coaching. Again, I've written a post that I want to direct you to called 3 Ways to Go Further Faster, but let me give these to you very quickly. You've got to get coaching if you're going to get more productive, because there are people that are outside of your life that will give you the ideas, the training, the perspective, frankly, that you need to get more productive. 3 ways to do that. One is to read. I try to read books on productivity, and one of the best books, I already gave you one, is The 4-Hour Workweek by Timothy Ferriss, but another one is Getting Things Done by David Allen, a tremendous classic in terms of productivity. So at least start with those two. But another thing, another way you can invest in your own coaching is to attend seminars and conferences. And there are a lot of them out there, but I pick up a gazillion ideas every year because I try to attend, not as a speaker, but as a participant, at least 3 conferences a year. And I come back with reams of paper, tons of notes, and a lot of action items as a result of that. And then the third thing I would suggest, or the third way that you could invest in your own coaching, is to hire a coach. I mean, literally, you could hire somebody that's either a one-time coach, and I've hired people to do that on special projects. Sometimes you can hire people that will give you ongoing coaching or consulting, and I've done that for years as well. But either way, this saves you time and money in the long run. Yes, you could probably learn what they know on your own, given enough time. The internet brings remarkable resources right to our desktop. The problem is, you probably don't have the time. It's not a good use of your time or money to reinvent the wheel. Why not go to someone who's already done that? Yes, pay a little bit of money, but get yourself, you know, really advancing toward the goal faster and getting the results that you want to get faster by doing that. So invest in your own coaching. That's hack number 7. Hack number 8, and this is similar, is acquire better tools. You know, sometimes we labor along with substandard tools or out-of-date software or out-of-date hardware, and we think we're being cost-conscious, but honestly, we're being stupid, because if we would invest in current tools, we would be able to work faster, more efficiently, and get more done in less time. I had a talk with my accountant recently, and we were talking about the state of my business, and she's a new accountant, so we are just getting to know each other. And one of the things that she asked me in this conversation was, she said, well, do you have any personal vices? And by that, I mean things that you just like to invest in, like, you know, race cars or vacation homes or that kind of thing. And I said, I really don't. You know, we live a pretty modest life, at least by our standards. And we don't invest in that kind of stuff. But I said, the one thing I do invest in is gadgets. And she said, well, tell me about that. And I said, well, I've got to have the latest computer, the latest software, the greatest smartphone, all that stuff. And she said, that's okay, because that makes you more efficient. That's a good investment. And so I started thinking about that. And I thought about this illustration. If a new smartphone will save you 10 minutes a day, 6 days a week, let's just take off Sunday just for the sake of illustration, that's 52 hours a week. That's an hour a week, an hour times 52, 52 hours a week. Now, if you make $50,000 a year, and I know how much most of you make because I did a survey recently, which I'm going to report on in a blog post, but I know that 60% of my audience, for example, makes $70,000 or more a year. But let's just take $50,000. If you make $50,000 a year and you're working on average 40 hours a week, that's $24 an hour. So 52 hours of your time are worth $1,248. So if investing in a smartphone will save you an hour a week, it's worth it to you to do so, because it's worth $1,248, and a smartphone's going to cost you way less than that. So you got to learn to think that way. If the return on the investment's going to be greater than the investment, then you'd be silly not to invest in the equipment or the software or the tool that would help you to be more efficient. So I think, as someone who's a leader, someone who's an entrepreneur, someone who is smart, that's how you got to think if you're going to be more productive. Acquire better tools. Number 9, get better at saying no. Okay, let me just preach it myself for a minute, because I still struggle with this. I've written on it extensively. In fact, if you search for this on my blog, you'll find a bunch of articles. One of the best posts I think I've written on this, one I have to go back and reread as though I were, you know, one person as the writer and another person as the reader, and just trying to learn from what I said there and apply it, which is the critical thing, which is, it's called How to Say No When You Feel Pressured to Say Yes. You know what I'm talking about? You get that email and somebody's begging you or shaming you or trying to get you to do something that you know you don't have time to do. Well, here's the ticket. Learn the power of a positive no. And it's got three parts, and I elaborate on these in the blog post, but it basically works like this. It begins by saying yes to yourself and protecting what is important to you. Every time you say yes to somebody else, guess what? You're saying no to yourself. You're saying no to your family. You're saying no to something that's really important. And sometimes you want to do that, but a lot of times we don't. I also think that the power of a positive no begins by affirming the other person in their request. You know, we don't have to shame them or make them feel guilty for asking. You know, that's to often do to others what we don't appreciate when it's done to us. And so to start with an affirmation of their request, I'm going to give you an illustration of this in just a minute, so hang tight. Second part of a powerful no, or a positive no, is to continue with a matter-of-fact no that sets clear boundaries. Now, I also avoid leaving the door open by saying maybe. Now, I'm tempted like you to say maybe. You know, like, well, maybe I can say yes to your request in the future, but not now. Much better, much cleaner, and trust me, you'll thank me later if you just go ahead and make a clean no right here when you're making a positive no. Third aspect of a positive no is to end with a yes that affirms the relationship and offers another solution to the person's request. You know, you may not be able to fulfill it personally, but you could point to something else. Maybe it's a book you've read or a blog post you've written or a friend that does this work professionally. It could be a variety of resources, but here's an example, and I use this in the blog post, but an example of somebody who's writing to me asking if I'll review their book proposal. Now, I used to do this professionally when I was an editor and then when I was a publisher in the publishing industry, but honestly, I don't have time anymore. And so here's an example from a guy named Bill who asked me if I would just take a few minutes and review his book proposal before he submitted it to an agent. So here's what I said. Bill, Congratulations on your new proposal. Very few authors make it this far. Thanks for your interest in having me review it. Now, right there is that first aspect of a positive no, which is to affirm him. And then here's what I say. Unfortunately, due to my other commitments, I'm no longer able to review proposals. Therefore, I must decline. Now, there's a very clear boundary. Basically, I'm not going to do it. And I can't do it because I've got other commitments. Surely you understand. And then I continue. However, I can give you some guidance on how to get published. If you haven't already done so, may I recommend that you start by reading my blog post, Advice for First-Time Authors. And there's a link in the email to that in this particular email that I'm writing to Bill. Now, I'm starting with a free solution. This is going to cost him nothing except a click on this article. And then I continue. In it, I offer step-by-step instructions for what to do first. Then I continue. I also have just published an entire audio course called Get Published, which distills my 30-plus years of publishing experience into 21 learning sessions. You can read about it here. And again, I have a link to that program in the email that I'm writing to Bill. And then I say, I hope you will find this helpful. Best of luck with your writing. Sincerely, Michael. So there's just an example of a positive no that begins with a yes, has a very matter-of-fact no, and then ends with a yes that affirms him as a person. So hack number 9 is get better at saying no and use templates for this. And in that blog post, you'll find a link to a bunch of templates, a bunch of free email templates that I offer on my site that'll help you to say no with really out having to think about it. So you don't have to gin yourself up emotionally each time, but you can just grab a template and reply to that particular situation. And then number 10, this is my 10th hack and my final hack, is use templates for everything. I read a book probably about 15 or 20 years ago called The E-Myth Revisited by Michael Gerber. Highly recommended. He's talking about why small businesses don't work. And the E-Myth is the entrepreneurial myth, which basically talks about why entrepreneurs fail. And one of the reasons they fail is that they don't construct repeatable processes or workflows or templates. And so what I want to encourage you to do is if you're doing some task and you envision yourself doing it repeatedly, template it. In other words, create it as if it were a prototype that's going to be repeated over and over again. So for example, when I write a blog post, I don't just begin from scratch. I've got a template for that. And I write about that in a post called The Anatomy of an Effective Blog Post. Again, a link in the show notes. You can go see what I'm talking about. But that's one example of a template, hundreds of templates that I use in my business to do tasks that I want to be able to repeat and improve upon and to optimize. I've got a template for my podcast as well, as you could probably imagine. So there are my best hacks, 10 of them. I hope they're helpful, but I've got a question for you. What is your best productivity hack? I would love to learn from you. I'm sure you've got some, but you can leave your answer at michaelhyatt.com/75, as in episode 75. Scroll down, you'll see the comment section, and you can leave your best productivity hack there. I'd love to hear you, and I'll be back after the break with our listener Q&A segment.
If you have something to say or sell in today's noisy world,
now you can get the inspiration, training, and tools you need to increase your influence and impact.
Platform University, a community of like-minded individuals led by one of Forbes magazine's top 50 social media influencers, Michael Hyatt.
Each month, you'll get access to
The Masterclass, where Michael interviews leading platform authorities.
Backstage Pass, a behind-the-scenes look at Michael's own platform business.
Member Makeover, with specific recommendations you can put to work now.
A live Q&A session where you can ask Michael your most burning questions.
And the discussion forum where our members support one another in their common quest.
Hi, this is Ryan Jenkins from ryan-jenkins.com. Participating in the member makeover of Platform University has been a true catalyst in taking my business and platform to a whole new level.
Intrigued? Now it is the time to invest in building your own platform, platformuniversity.com.
Okay, welcome back. We had a variety of questions this week, and as you may remember, now I'm taking questions that are all over the map. They don't have to be related to the topic. They can be about anything I write or speak about. But the first one comes from Ryan.
Hi, Michael. I'm Ryan Parker, and you can find my podcast, The Food Craftsman, in iTunes or at foodcraftsman.com. I want to thank you for all of the great insights you've given us through your podcasts and blog posts. I also wanted to say how much I really enjoyed the three-part series you did with your wife. It was great to hear her perspective as well. In your last podcast, you discussed not leaving your job without having something you are driving towards. Unfortunately for me, this came just 8 days after leaving my day job. I really enjoyed the work, but no longer enjoyed where I was doing the work. When resigning my position, I offered 4 weeks' notice to help with any transitions I could. I knew from past experiences when others resigned from this particular company, they were probably not going to honor that time frame, and I was right. My question is, when leaving a company you feel will not give you a great recommendation or support in finding new work, how do you best handle that when going into a new job opportunity? My fear is that even though I have received positive work evaluations, when being called upon, the company will not reflect those in reference checks. Michael, thank you for your great personal contributions. I give out your platform book like it was candy to anyone who asks on how to build a platform.
Wow, Ryan, what a great question. I did a podcast on this. It's episode number 41 called 7 Steps to Take Before You Quit Your Job. And one of them is to just purpose before you quit. And I know this for you is after the fact, so don't let this podcast make you feel guilty about what you should have done, but let it inform you for what you might should do in the future. And maybe you did all these things, I don't know. But one of the things it talks about is purposing to leave your current position with dignity and honor. And I think it's really possible to do that. And you really talked about that or spoke to that when you said you gave them 4 weeks' notice. That was really beyond the call of duty. That was honoring them. But to do those kinds of things that leave them feeling great about you, you know, sorry to lose you, would be delighted to have a chance to hire you back if they had the opportunity. But I think it begins with putting yourself in your boss's shoes or in your employer's shoes and asking, if you were going to leave, how would you like that to go? And so I think advance notice is one aspect to that. Another thing is making sure that all the files are updated and all the work is caught up and it's not a mess. I've inherited those kind of jobs. You probably have too, where the person before you just left an absolute mess. In fact, one time one of my early jobs in the publishing industry was I followed a guy who got angry because he got laid off. And then he came back later on and tried to apply for this job that I was applying for. The only reason he didn't get the job, because frankly, he was more qualified than I. The reason he didn't get the job is because when he first left the company, and it had been a couple of years since he left when he got laid off, he had trashed his office. He literally opened up his files and emptied paper on the floor, and he left really stomped out. And even though it was a new boss, that kind of story traveled within the company, and it was common folklore by the time he came back. And he didn't get the job because nobody would consider him because of the way that he left. Obviously, that's an extreme. But I'm just saying, leave things in the shape you'd like to find them if you were your own successor. And so I think some of those common sense things can, I don't know if you could say they could guarantee you a positive recommendation from an employer, but they will go a long way towards increasing the probability that you get one. I will say this, because I've been on the receiving end of those phone calls when people are calling for a reference. I prefer giving a positive reference. I don't want to give anything negative. I want to give something positive if I possibly can. So wow me, exceed my expectations. And that's what I think you need to do as an employee. What does the employer expect? How can you exceed that? Go the second mile. Really make yourself available to follow up, to answer questions, to even train your successor. Those are some of the things I would look at. The next question comes from Shirley.
Hi, Michael. My name is Shirley Showalter, and I am calling from Harrisonburg, Virginia. My website is shirleyshowalter.com. I'm so excited with the success of my memoir, Blush, A Mennonite Girl Meets a Glittering World. It's into its second printing after only a few weeks of publication. But how do I move from my great buzz and support in my modest core audience to finding a larger audience?
Shirley, this is absolutely the right question, because most authors publish a book, and not only does the publisher forget about it, like, you know, 2 to 4 weeks after it's published because they're on to the next thing, but most authors have done their best. They've made their, you know, ta-da entrance, and they've got nothing left in terms of growing their audience. That really needs to be, and I'm really not talking to you, Shirley, but anybody who aspires to be an author needs to be part of the marketing plan from the get-go. What's the ongoing program of promotion once the initial launch begins to die down? How are you going to keep it visible? How are you going to begin to build an audience? Because that first month or so can be a great foundation. Unfortunately, for a lot of authors, that's a last hurrah. And I would advise you and everybody else listening to not think of it in that way. Let me just give you one tip. One way to find a larger audience for your book, and it's an idea that comes from chapter 38 of my book, Platform Get Noticed in a Noisy World. This is the only chapter, by the way, that was written by somebody that wasn't me. This was written by my friend Jeff Goins, and it's called Write Guest Posts. And this is something that Jeff did to grow his blog readership, and it ultimately got him a book deal. But that's to find the audiences where you think you have affinity. In other words, this person's audience would really enjoy my book if I could just get to it. But there's a gatekeeper, and it's that blogger. So how can I write content, create something of value to his audience, so he will voluntarily want to give me an opportunity on his platform to speak to his audience? And I've done that repeatedly with my own audience, and that is give room for guest posters to write. I don't do it as much anymore simply because I don't really have the bandwidth for it, and I tend to give preference to people who are our faculty at Platform University. But find a blogger that has an audience like the audience that you want, or a podcaster that has an audience like an audience you'd like to have access to, and then begin to initiate the relationship. And by the way, the best time to do that is not when you need a favor. You know, the best way to do that is to be generous with that person in terms of retweeting or reposting their content on Facebook, build a relationship, participate in their community, and then create some content that you think would be useful to their audience and approach them about running that. Again, there's more detail in that chapter in my book. The next question comes from Wendy.
Hi, Michael. This is Wendy with servicewithasmileblog.com. My question is, as you can tell by the name of my blog, I added the actual word blog to the domain name, and that's because Service with a Smile was already taken. Is that going to be a problem down the line, having the actual word blog on my domain name?
Wendy, first of all, that's not ideal. Obviously, you recognize that, otherwise you wouldn't have asked the question. But is it a problem? No, I don't think so. I mean, it's probably the best of some other choices that maybe are not as good. But I don't think it's a problem. You know, you could go with a different extension on your domain name, like a .org extension or a .cc extension or a .us extension, or there's a variety of them out there, as you probably know. But from my perspective, it doesn't really matter. If you can't get the .com version of your name, then kind of, you know, anything will do, because most people are going to bookmark or hyperlink to it. And it just needs to be, insofar as you can make it memorable, it needs to be memorable. So a blog at the end of it, at the end of your name, is probably about the best you can do. I wouldn't sweat over that. I would just get busy creating great content, because at the end of the day, that's the thing that will really make the difference. Well, that's all the time we have this week for questions. If you've got a question on any topic, please go to michaelhyatt.com/podcast question and leave me a voicemail. It's very easy. I would love to hear from you, but this is also a terrific way to promote your site, because if I use your question on the air, not only will you get to mention your URL on the air, but I'll also provide a link back to your site in the show notes. Now for our tip of the week, I want to talk to you a little bit about an application called Focus at Will that my friend Stu McLaren introduced me to. But it's basically a music site, but it's a special kind of music site, and it goes hand in glove with our topic this week of productivity. This music site is based on the science of psychoacoustics, in other words, how music impacts our productivity, and it's a result of several studies that have been done showing what kinds of music, and it's specific kinds of music, that will increase your productivity when you play it. Terrific site. I've been using it for the past week, and I absolutely think it's impacted my productivity. I've done this with a playlist in the past that I've put together, and I think I've, you know, kind of stumbled into some of these ideas on my own, but this takes it to an entirely different level. So again, the website is Focus at Will. There's a lot of different genres there: ambient music, spa music, classical music, pop music, but it's all selected to make you more productive. And again, it's called Focus at Will. Focus, the word A-T, at will.com. Well, that's it for this episode of This Is Your Life. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please show the love by going to michaelhyatt.com/love and tweeting a link to the show, I'd be ever so grateful. This will help us get the word out and increase my visibility in iTunes so that people can discover the show on their own. But until next time, remember, your life is a gift. Now go make it count. This is your